Well, I know a lot of us here, maybe not all of us, but a lot of us here are at a place in our lives where things are changing. And honestly, throughout your life, that's going to happen quite a bit. I can think back in times to my life where something dramatically changes, so much so that I just know I'm never going back to that place I was, whatever it was, in school or a job. One of the earliest times I can remember is when I was somewhere around 7 or 8 years old, and someone in our family, very close to us, very important, it was a grandfather, he passed. And I just remember that feeling that, and I don't know how to describe it properly, just an odd feeling, a sad feeling, of course, like in the case of a death, but it's not always a sad feeling, just an odd feeling of knowing that life has changed. And you're not going to go back to that place anymore. You'll never have that place or that opportunity, those friends, whatever they are, things change. But you're going to your next step in life. And let me ask this. Let me ask this to start out. What do you want out of life? What do you want out of life? Think about it. What do you want out of life? To our young people, older people, middle-aged people, what do you want out of life? I might define it in one simple word, and your brain could go to a number of places. You could say it differently or think it differently. I'll just simply say success. You want to be successful in life. Whatever that means, you want to be successful in life. I want to be successful in life. Success can be defined like this: the accomplishment of an aim or purpose. It's the accomplishment of an aim or purpose. How do we define success? The accomplishment of an aim or purpose. What's your purpose in life? What's your aim or the goal, the thing you're trying to attain or shoot for? What is that? In today's world, well, actually in the history of humanity, here's one of the main ways I think people could define it if we're honest with ourselves. And I don't mean you and I specifically, us here in this room, but just in general, I think a lot of folks in the world would define it this way, and that is as wealth, a lot of wealth. I went to Forbes.com as I was thinking about this message. As I was thinking about success and purpose and aim and what we really want to get out of life, because there's a lot that life has to offer. There's a lot, and you'll go through many stages in life. What is our purpose or aim? And I thought about this wealth. So I got to Forbes.com, and I typed in, or I looked up, according to them, what the richest people in the world are. And they give a long list. The top four, I knew three out of the top four, but the first one is a man named Bernard Arnault and his family. They say, and family. And I wasn't familiar with him. He's a French businessman, investor, and specifically CEO of LVMH. I didn't bother looking up what that acronym stood for, but it's the world's largest luxury goods company. So if you want to get mega wealthy, make some luxury good items that you can sell to other really wealthy people. You're feeding off the wealth of others. Anyways, his net worth is valued at, this is from Forbes.com, and their website says they updated, I think it was daily or maybe every 12 hours or something. At the time I looked this up a couple of days ago, it was $231 billion. $231 billion. Wow, what does that mean? I don't know. Elon Musk came in second at that time a couple of days ago. He was $208 billion. That was his net value. I know him. Jeff Bezos was $198 billion. Mark Zuckerberg was $175 billion, $175 billion. Well, if we look in the Bible, like we heard this morning, the real source of truth, the best place to look at anything, who would you say is one of the most successful people? And again, you could define it how you want to. What do you think of as success? Who is one of the most successful people? If I think about this both in biblical terms to some degree, but also worldly terms, the first person that comes to my mind anyways is Solomon. He was very successful. Turn back with me over to 1 Kings 3. I'd like to just start this first verse and see. Now, we may argue this, you know, as we read about Solomon's life, some of the things he did, maybe how he ended up. Maybe we'll argue whether or not he really was successful. But if you turn back over to 1 Kings 3, because again, I want to be successful in life, and I know the young folks here, all of us, want to be successful in life, and God gives us the keys to success. In fact, I'll just go ahead and tell you, in this sermon, this main message here, I have three biblical principles, and the title of the sermon is Biblical Principles for Success. And I've just got, in general, three. Again, we could break it down maybe in a number of ways. I've got three, and I've started with the least important going to the most important. So I'm just telling you that. Don't fall asleep, please. I don't want to lose your attention because I want to get to the most important principle for success. In 1 Kings 3, verse 1, here's Solomon. He comes to Gibeon. Solomon made a treaty with Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and married Pharaoh's daughter. Then he brought her to the city of David until he had finished building his own house and the house of the Lord, the wall all around Jerusalem. Meanwhile, the people sacrificed at the high places because there was no house built for the name of the Lord until those days. And Solomon loved the Lord. He loved the Lord, walking in the statutes of his father David, except that he sacrificed and burned incense at the high places. And you'll find this as well if you go on through the histories of kings. You'll find that, yes, some did good. Some did kind of sort of good. There's a lot of variation. You'll find that some did really good, except that, and there's that exception. Maybe not quite all the way there. Solomon didn't do quite like David did. Anyways, verse 4, the king went to Gibeon to sacrifice there, for that was the great high place. And Solomon offered 1,000 burnt offerings on that altar. At Gibeon, the Lord appeared to Solomon in a dream by night, and God said, wow, how would you like this to happen? I mean, you know, we have child stories, fables of genies in a bottle, blah, blah, blah. But what if God himself asked you or told you this? Now, he didn't ask. He said, ask. And then he asked, what shall I give you? That's amazing. Solomon said, you have shown great mercy to your servant David, my father, because he walked before you in truth, righteousness, uprightness of heart with you, and you have continued this great kindness for him, and you have given him a son to sit on his throne as it is this day. So Solomon starts answering God by recollecting what God has already blessed him with. A good way to start our prayers, right? Recognizing the blessing, giving thanks. Verse 7, now, O my Lord, you have made your servant king instead of my father David, but I am a little child. I don't know how to go out or come in. And your servant is in the midst of your people, whom you have chosen, a great people, too numerous to be numbered or counted. Now, Solomon's grown. He's young, evidently early in his kingship, but he calls himself, in a humble recognition of himself, he calls himself a little kid. Hey, the first step to wisdom is recognizing that, yeah, you're a child and you really don't know. Your servant is in the midst of your people, and you have chosen a great people, too numerous to be numbered or counted. Therefore, give to your servant an understanding heart to judge your people, that I may discern between good and evil. For who is able to judge this great people of yours? And of course, that pleased God very much. I'm not going to read any more. But if we go on, we know that God did bless him with what he asked for, that judgment, wisdom, discernment, and so much more. Now, God had plans for him to build a temple. We know that. But he blessed Solomon with very much wealth. Let me read just a couple sentences from our UCG commentary about this vast wealth of Solomon. When I read about those people, those first four people from Forbes.com, these super wealthy people with billions, how does that compare to Solomon? Again, I think of Solomon as being one of the most successful or the most successful people, depending on how you define the term, in the Bible. How does that compare? Well, from UCG commentary, The vast wealth of Solomon is attributed to his far-flung trading empire. Not only did wealth pour in from the eastern desert traders, so east of him through the Arabian desert, the Arabian traders and the governors of subject satellite nations, but on top of that, Solomon's annual inflow of gold bullion was 666 talents. That's more, in our terms of weight, the commentary goes on to say, that's more than 125,000 pounds. More than 125,000 pounds. With a current value of more than U.S. dollars, $500 million. That was his annual. By the way, let me ask just the younger folks in here, let's say less than 25 or so, who wants to be wealthy? You could be honest. I'll put up my hand. I'm older than 25. Who wants to be wealthy? Or who appreciates, if nothing else, just having the security? You don't have to wonder where your food's going to come from. Maybe some of us were a little scared to put up our hands, but, you know, I don't need $500 million, but, yeah, we all want financial security. I looked up a couple other sources on Solomon, and I'm just curious, because, again, these people I listed in the beginning that have, say, $200-something billion, what was Solomon's net worth? And frankly, I'm just going to say it has to be speculation. There's no way to know for certain. But a couple of the speculations I read from other sources say somewhere around $2 trillion. If that's right or not, honestly, I just don't know. 200 trillion, if it's, or sorry, 2 trillion. But if it's half that, if it's a trillion or half of a trillion, that's far more than any of the wealth we have today. It's an amazing amount. One way we could be successful is like this. Let me read just a couple more things to you, and then I want to get into these three biblical principles of success. This is from BetterUp.com. I'm just going to skim through this real fast. Here are 7 steps of a life plan. If you want to be successful in life, here's 7 steps. I'm just going to read the short version. 1 is create a vision. Come up with a vision. Where you want to be? You know, I asked earlier, what sort of purpose do you want in life? What's your goal or your aim? 2 is perform a self-assessment. See where you're at. 3, prioritize life. Prioritize. 4, identify your values. 5 is to establish the goals, what goals you want to achieve. 6, outline an action plan. How are you going to get to those goals? And 7, because in case you haven't learned yet, you never really know, and this is something Solomon finds out, you never really know what's going to happen in life. So the 7th step was adjust as necessary. Adjust as necessary. So I've got my action plan, and something comes along and messes it up, and, well, start over. I don't know. Adjust as necessary. Well, Solomon, as he lived and experienced a whole lot, if you turn over to the book of Ecclesiastes, I'm going to give you this first principle. And I believe this, of the 3 principles I have listed here, I consider this to be the least important, but it is a principle for success. If you turn over to Ecclesiastes 11, I'm going to turn and read just a few verses of a place, frankly, I find a little bit difficult to grasp or understand. And maybe it's not so shocking if Solomon was wise, and indeed he was blessed like no other. Well, it's not really surprising that I don't understand this so well. Turn over to Ecclesiastes 11, and I'd like to go to this first point. And this first point is, I'll go ahead and say it, it is to try a variety of things. Try a variety of things. Diversify your investments, diversify your experiences, try different things. Travel, try out, if you like sports or the arts, whatever it is, try different things. Solomon, I'm not going to read where he says that earlier in the book of Ecclesiastes, but Solomon tried, so many different things. He tried a lot of different things. And it's a good piece of advice for you and I Because again, we don't know everything that's going to happen in life. We don't know every detailed part of the plan. We know God's big plan for us. And in fact, I'll just say as a side note, thankfully, we know the most important part of God's plan and purpose for us. And that is, as we go through life, no matter where we're at, it is for us to develop godly character. To develop godly character, to grow in faith. And this is a side point, but let's look at this. Ecclesiastes 11, verse 1. Ecclesiastes 11, verse 1. He says, cast your bread upon the waters, for you will find it after many days. Give a serving to seven and also to eight, for you do not know what evil will be on the earth. And that's what I said a moment ago. We really don't know. Evil doesn't necessarily mean wicked or sin. It just means bad things happen. Calamity happens. Unexpected things happen in life. And like I say, it can change the plan. Maybe we have to wad up the piece of paper and start over. Cast your bread upon the waters, for you will find it after many days. What does that mean? You'll find a variety of interpretations. One thing it could mean, which seems likely to me, and this is just me thinking, yes, this could mean this. Reading in the context of these few verses, perhaps it's a reference to merchant trading, right? Merchant ships, trading, casting your bread upon the waters, and having that long-awaited anticipation, oh, where's the return at? Right? I sent my goods or shipment several weeks or months ago, maybe in these times, could even be years in some cases. But you sent these things, and you just have to trust and wait that there will be a return on it. Give a serving to seven and also to eight. Verse 2, what a wonderful principle. You send out these breads on many different waters, and you get the return. Guess what? Be generous. Share. Give a serving to seven, seven being the number of complete. Also to eight, generous, completed, and beyond a little bit. Beyond a little bit. One thing we do see in these verses too, this goes along with this first point, trying a variety of things, is to put in the work, put in the effort, work at it. I've heard somewhere along the line, because I've tried playing piano, and I know very, very little, and I don't know the technical terms, I've never taken classes before, but I've read somewhere along the lines regarding an instrument and maybe other things as well, that it takes something like 1,000 hours to become proficient at it. It's some huge number like that. If you practice every single day, that's an hour a day for, what, 3 years, give or take? That's a long time. But put in the work. Solomon says this, to put in the effort. If the clouds are full of rain, they empty themselves upon the earth. And if a tree... if a tree falls to the south or to the north, in the place where the tree falls, there it will lie. So what's he mean there? The tree, I don't know, it's just observing action and reaction maybe. Or maybe he's saying the tree dies. You know, verse 2 says you don't know what evil will be on the earth. Maybe you don't know. Maybe you didn't want the tree to fall. You didn't plan for it, but it happened anyways. Verse 4, he who observes the wind will not sow, and he who regards the clouds will not reap. Huh, how does that apply to us? He who observes the wind will not sow. Whoever regards the clouds will not reap. Does that mean we shouldn't look at the clouds or the wind or pay no attention to it? Is that not beneficial to just look at our surroundings? Well, what Solomon's saying here, and even in the next couple of verses, is don't let the uncertainty of something hold you back. And I'll say this with a caveat. Take risks. Take risks. Take them. Let me put something on with that. That is to get wise counsel about the risk. Not blindly. You know, go to your parents. Go to trusted sources. And ask opinions or get counsel from them, but take risk. Life is full of risk. I was just speaking frankly, on our way here, driving through Atlanta traffic, we took a risk to get here. And it was well worth it. It was well worth it. We're here together fellowshipping and keeping God's Sabbath day holy. It's definitely worth it, but it's a risk. You take a risk every day. When there's things in life, things that you think are good, and God gives us His loving and perfect law to help guide us, you know, give us guidelines within which to work. But within those guidelines, again, there's so much diversity, so many things we can do and enjoy in life within God's parameters. So take risk. Try different things. As you do not know what is the way of the wind, verse 5, he says you don't know. Now, you know, today, I'm just thinking about weather. We have meteorologists who go to school for how many years or study these things, and they give us pretty good weather reports. Next time, if you haven't done this and you have a weather app on your phone, sometime go and look at the weekly report and see what the weather's going to be like 7 days from now. And keep your eye on that particular day, whatever it is, Thursday, and go back the next day and see. It changes a little bit. And the next day, and the next day. And pretty soon, that 100% chance of weather that was going to rain you out of your pickleball game, well, it's only 3% this morning. The skies are clear, sunny, you know. Yeah, we don't know. As you do not know, what is the way of the wind? If it's time to plant, go plant. If it's time to invest, time to start a job, time to go to college, don't think about all the reasons or things why you shouldn't, or all those what ifs. You know, if we live our life in a mode or mentality of thinking, what if, it's very debilitating. What if? And you won't move forward. Think about things critically. Again, get sound counsel. Get wisdom from others who are older, more experienced. But take risk. We don't know what's the way of the wind or how the bones grow in the womb of her who is with child. So you do not know the works of God who makes everything. We do know the plan of God. We know God's way. But nobody, including Solomon, doesn't know every little thing that's going to happen in your life. We just have to live it. That's what he's saying. In the morning, sow your seed, and in the evening, do not withhold your hand. For you don't know which will prosper. You know, you can go out and plant stuff in the morning, in the evening, this week, this month, next month, and you don't know what will prosper. Again, do a variety of things. Live life and try a variety of things. You do not know which will prosper, either this or that, or whether both alike will be good. As I said, God does give us much variety within His creation and different things we can do in life. In Scripture, we find a variety of occupations. And I know I'm not just speaking to folks who are will be going into college or seeking a career soon, but think about this. We have a variety of occupations by people who lived godly lives and served God. We have builders, physician, shepherd, housewife, seamstress, potter, seller of purple, tent maker, fisher, lots of fishermen, midwife, sower, silversmith, merchant, cupbearer, Nehemiah the cupbearer for the king. Also, some of the things we may not think of, soldier, tax collector. How do you want to be a tax collector? Work for the IRS. You know, we live in the world. And we get jobs in the world, and we are part of the system. We are part of society. We are part of it in the way that Christ said not to take them out of the world. In John 17, on the eve of the Passover, that's what he prayed for his disciples, not to take them out. He left them in the world. Of course, he and the Father wanted them to be in the world. He wanted them to be a light to the world, an example to preach the gospel. We're not taken out of the world. God does not tell us or expect us to have no part in any way within the world. He doesn't want us to look morally, spiritually like the world. There's no doubt about that. Notice in Luke 3, here's John preaching a message of baptism and repentance to the people. He's in the wilderness and they come to him. And it's almost like this scene in Acts 2 where the people hear the message and they're struck and they say, oh, what shall we do? What will we do? Luke chapter 3, Luke 3, verse 10. So the people asked him, right, they're listening to John preach this message of repentance, and they ask him, what shall we do then? He answered and said to them, he who has two tunics, let him give to him who has none. Be generous. That harkens back to Ecclesiastes. Be generous. Give to him who has none, and he who has food, let him do likewise. In other words, share. Think about your neighbor. Or as the commandment says, love your neighbor. Love your neighbor. Then, notice this, tax collectors, I said soldiers and tax collectors, because John talks to those two groups of people here, people that were looked down upon, thought of as sinners, or corrupt, or oppressive, whatever the case may be. The tax collectors also came to him to be baptized and said to him, teacher, what shall we do? He said to them, collect no more than what's appointed for you. He didn't say, come out of this career path. This is not good for you. It's part of this Roman oppressive system. No, he didn't say that. He said, collect no more what is appointed for you. Likewise, the soldiers asked him, saying, what shall we do? So he said to them, don't intimidate anyone or accuse falsely. Be content with your wages. Be content. What's he saying? He's saying, live where you're at and live a godly life. He's saying, maybe a better way to say it would be, serve God wherever you are. Be a light or example. Whatever path you go down, serve God where you are. Be a light. I'm going to look real quick before we move on to this next point at just a couple examples here on this first point. And this is because at different stages in life, and I know we're all in here, again, at different stages in life, I have my own road and path to walk currently. But in Luke chapter 2, verse 36, we're going to go to the other end. I mean, I know I have my mind directed towards some of us younger folks. We're going to go to the other end of the spectrum for a moment and look at someone quite old. Luke chapter 2 and verse 36. This is around the time of the nativity of Christ or when he came. He was born. And there's this lady, Anna, who is a prophetess. Luke 2:36. Now there was one Anna, a prophetess, the daughter of Phanuel of the tribe of Asher. She's an Israelite. She was of a great age and had lived with a husband 7 years from her virginity. So she's a really old woman, and she was married for 7 years, but for the rest of the time, a widow. She was a widow of about 84 years, not necessarily meaning she's been a widow for 84 years, but her age is 84. She's an old woman, and how does she do? How does she serve God and live life? Well, she did not depart from the temple, but served God with fasting and prayers night and day. Night and day. There's a good example. Fasting and prayers. Okay, turn with me over to Luke 19. I want to contrast a couple of things. Thinking of older folks and younger folks and everybody in between. And I say this for this purpose. Sometimes when we read these examples, we have to realize people are in a certain place and time in life. When I was in my 30s and I worked long hours, I was going to school. My wife is at home and she is pregnant. And I'm working at Chick-fil-A, busting tables, cleaning up. And my wife texts me sometime around noon or 1 o'clock. And she texts me and says, I've been having contractions, you know, today. And they started, I forget what she said exactly, 5 or 6 o'clock that morning. And I said, what? What? You know, this is our first child. It's exciting. But I think, I got up for work this morning. Why didn't you tell me when I went to work that you were having contractions, about to have a baby? I want to be there, you know? Well, I was busy. I had a job, and she was just kind of waiting to see, you know, because once they start, it could take a while, I suppose. My point is, I am busy with a full-time job, have college. God knows where we are at in life. He knows what we can and cannot do, what we can and cannot handle. And more specifically, in regards to these couple of stories I'm reading, where we can and cannot serve at the time or in that moment. Thinking of the woman who was at the temple fasting day and night with prayers and fasting, and did not depart from the temple. You know, if you're a young man or woman and you have a family and a full-time job, you can't do that. You can't neglect your family. God doesn't expect you to. He expects you to be responsible and take care of your family. Anyways, moving on, Luke 19. Let's read about Zacchaeus. He's interesting, and we don't really have much information, or I'd say any information besides what's here in these few verses. Jesus entered, and he passed through Jericho, Luke 19:1. And behold, there was a man named Zacchaeus who was a chief tax collector, and he was rich. He was rich, and he sought to see who Jesus was, but could not because of the crowd, for he was of short stature. He's a short guy, and I'm going to guess that he's a bit on the younger side. I don't know. He's rich. I'm going to guess he's a bit on the younger side because verse 4 says he ran ahead, and he climbs up into a sycamore tree. I think I'm too old to climb a sycamore tree. I'm 40. How old is this guy? I don't know. But he is someone. He's rich and a chief tax collector. He climbs into a sycamore tree to see him, for he was going to pass that way. And when Jesus came to the place, he looked up and saw him and said to him, Zacchaeus, make haste and come down, for today I must stay at your house. So Zacchaeus made haste. He came down and received him joyfully. And when they saw it, they all complained, saying, he has gone to be a guest with a man who is a sinner. And then notice what Zacchaeus says. Remember, he's a rich chief tax collector. He says to Jesus, he says, look, Lord, I give half of my goods to the poor. And if I have taken anything from anyone by false accusation, I restore fourfold. I can't give half my goods to the poor. I'm just making the point again. Wherever Zacchaeus was at is not where I'm at. I can't. I have to feed my family. You are to be generous, you know, like we read from Solomon's advice, but wherever you are at in life and in whatever way you are blessed, therewith we serve God to the best of our ability. And God calls people from many different places, levels of wealth, or we could say levels of poverty. He calls many people from many different places. Let's serve God where we are at. Okay, Second Chronicles. Let me read a story of a king here for our second point. Second Chronicles chapter 24. Our first point was, try a variety of things. This second point is, I believe, even more important. It's a very important biblical principle, more important than the first. And we can get this perhaps from a variety of places. If you turn over to 2 Chronicles chapter 24, we read about this king, Joash. Joash is interesting. He became king at a very early age. If you remember Athaliah, his grandmother, she murdered his siblings or his other brothers. When Joash was a baby or very young age, his father, the king, died, and Athaliah, Azariah, his father's mother, father's mother, sister, brother, cousin, Joash's grandmother went through and killed a very corrupt and evil woman to take it upon herself to have the crown, to be the ruler. And Joash was spared. He was hidden. And then when he was 7 years old, in the seventh year, chapter 23 says, Jehoiada strengthened himself and he made a covenant. And this priest Jehoiada saved Joash and brought him in to be king and killed Athaliah, his wicked grandmother. And Jehoiada helps Joash. And you read stories of the king sometimes when they're made king at a very early young age, a very impressionable age. By the way, do we have any 7 or 8 year olds in here? Some? None brave enough to raise a hand if there are, but hey, 7 or 8 years old, how young? Can you imagine what it would be like to be king? There's no doubt Joash and maybe others that were like that as well, they had people help them, raise them, guide them. Of course, they didn't just sit on the throne and pound, you know, like a little 7-year-old, what they're going to do that day or how much candy they're going to eat. No, they had guidance and help, and Jehoiada helped Joash. The Second Kings account says that this thing we're about to read took place in the 23rd year of his reign. So Joash, he was made king at 7, and for about 23 years at least, we can't pinpoint when this happens, Jehoiada is with him, a good person, a good priest that leads him in the right way. Chapter 24, verse 1, Joash was 7 years old when he became king, and he reigned 40 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Zibiah of Beersheba, and Joash did what was right in the sight of the Lord all the days of Jehoiada the priest. And Jehoiada took 2 wives for him, and he had sons and daughters. And it happened after this that Joash set his heart on repairing the house of the Lord. Joash did good things under the guidance, direction, leadership of Jehoiada. And I would say it in this way, that Jehoiada influenced him in a good way. Verse 15, we're skipping on through the story. Verse 15, 2 Chronicles 24:15. Jehoiada grew old and was full of days, and he died. He was 130 years old when he died, an old man. They buried him in the city of David among the kings, because he had done good in Israel, both toward God and his house. And then notice what happens in verse 17. After the death of Jehoiada, this king that was grew up and was guided, influenced, no doubt, by Jehoiada all of his life, the leaders of Judah came and bowed down to the king, and the king listened to them. He inclined his ear to them. He heard what they had to say. Huh, there's a different way. There's a different way. We can do things differently. The leaders of Judah came and bowed down to the king, and the king listened to them, and therefore, and the tragic part of the story is that they left the house of the Lord, of the Lord God of their fathers, and they served wooden images and idols. And wrath came upon Judah and Jerusalem because of their trespass. He sent them prophets to them and to bring them back to the Lord, and they testified against them, but they would not listen. What happened to Joash? He was 7 years old. Jehoiada was with him at least 23 years, if we add up these things from the Second Kings account. So he's 30 years old, at least by the time Jehoiada dies. Is that not a developed and matured person by that point, that when Jehoiada did pass, that he would continue on the right way? Well, that's bringing me to this second point here. And we can say, speculate, or maybe just pull out of the story that, yes, Joash was never grounded in God's way, and he never really took it to heart. But I'm going to pull this lesson from it, because this is certainly a lesson. And that is, and the point for you is to choose good company. Choose good company. Make good relationships. You can make bad relationships, and they will influence you in a bad way. We don't choose our siblings. You didn't choose your brother or sister or your parent, right? There are many relationships we can't choose, but there are a lot that we can. We do choose our friends. Does God give us guidance on making friends? This is a very important biblical principle for a successful life. Turn with me over to 1 Corinthians 5, because I think sometimes, or perhaps you've had this thought as a young person, let's see, does God want me to just totally reject everyone in the world that's not a good person? You'd be a lonely person. You really would. Does God want me totally to reject everyone? In 1 Corinthians chapter 5, you know, Paul deals with a lot of problems in the church at Corinth, and he's dealing specifically with, think about this, he's dealing with the brethren. In chapter 5, that's who he's talking about. Chapter 5 and verse 9, 1 Corinthians 5, 9, he says, I wrote to you in my epistle not to keep company. Now, he doesn't say make friends, so maybe we're not talking about friends. What is a friend, by the way? Well, we'll talk about that in a moment. But he's saying not to keep company with, or the margin says be an acquaintance with sexually immoral people. He says, yet I certainly, and you can read earlier in the chapter to see what he's talking of specifically. He's talking about within the church. Verse 10, I certainly did not mean with the sexually immoral people of this world or with the covetous, people who are wanting, greedy for gain, greedy for money, just looking to enjoy the many pleasures of life, whatever that may be, or extortioners, people who take advantage of other people, idolaters. Since then, if you can't keep company with those people, well, like I said, you would be lonely. Since then, you would need to go out of the world. But now I have written you to not keep company with anyone named a brother who is sexually immoral, covetous, an idolater, a reviler, a drunkard, an extortioner, not even to eat with such a person. Paul's being pretty specific here. He's talking about within the church, someone that's supposed to be, knows God's way, and yet they're living a hypocritical lifestyle. They're actually doing those other things that they shouldn't do. He's not talking about those people in the world. He says, if that were the case, well, you would need to come out of the world. So how do you choose your friends or relationships in the world? How can we do that? Turn over to Proverbs. Proverbs, we have much wisdom here on association, making friends, various manners. Proverbs 12 and verse 26. Proverbs chapter 12 and verse 26, it says this, and I'll just go ahead and say, if I get to my point here in a moment, God doesn't specifically tell us, yes, you choose this person as a friend and not that one, but we have biblical principle and guidance in doing so. Proverbs 12 and verse 26, how do you choose friends? Well, the righteous should choose his friends carefully, for the way of the wicked leads them astray. The way of the wicked leads the righteous astray. So you can try to live God's way. You can commit and be dedicated and faithful to God, but the way of the wicked leads them astray. Can the righteous be led astray? Can the righteous be led astray? That's what the proverb says. Can they? Could someone pull you away from God? Is that possible? At some point in my life, somewhere around when I was baptized, I had a good friend who lived next door, and he knew I kept the Sabbath. He knew I went to church on Saturday. He thought I was weird for it, perhaps. But I kept company with him. We were pretty good friends. And sometime around this, I would call it a time of dedication that I thought about baptism and committing to God. He took me away on Friday evening one afternoon to do some work. And I really knew it all along that it might get me in trouble as we got closer to sunset that day. But it ended up happening nonetheless. And I worked with him into the Sabbath. And I felt guilty about that, of course, and I repented later. But I thought, I can want to keep the Sabbath, and my friend here is not against me, because he wasn't against me. We were friends. How do you choose friends? Well, here's a good way. Maybe here's a good principle we could look at. If someone starts to pull you away from doing what you know God expects of you to do, that's a good point to or time and place to start distancing yourself, to get away from that person. Maybe they're not the good friend that you want to have, that you need to have, that's best for you. Chapter 13, verse 20. Think about this. He who walks with wise men will be wise, but the companion of fools will be destroyed. What's that mean? If you walk with wise people, you'll be wise. It means they influence you. They help you, influence you, and can build you up in the right way. And on the other hand, in contrast, the companion of fools will be destroyed. 1 Corinthians 15:33 says, do not be deceived. Evil company corrupts. Evil company corrupts good habits. Do not be deceived. 2 Corinthians 6:14. You remember that verse. It speaks of being unequally yoked with someone, right? Being unequally yoked, being yoked as in oxen. I'm not calling you an ox, by the way. But we have the symbol, the picture of ox yoked together. And this bar that goes across their necks, and they're used to do a work or to plow a field, and they're attached together with one another. And it's guaranteed. It's not if, probably, likely, or one ox has a better idea than the other. Whichever way one ox goes, the other ox will go. There's never any alternate scenario there. One ox is stronger, and he's going to pull the weaker. But, well, no, they go together. They go together in the same direction. You can't go different directions. Let me look at one more place before I move on to the next point. John 15, to tie in with this second point, choose good company, choose your friends wisely. Again, God doesn't tell us, he doesn't just give us an outline or list or names of people to be friends with, but we do have biblical principle. Specifically here in John 15, starting in verse 13, we see the example of Christ and who he calls his friends. Who are Christ's friends? Or the Greek word used in the New Testament for friends is philos. It's where we get the word phileo from, the word for what you've heard as brotherly love, or it's a type of friendship love. It's actually a relational thing. It's two-sided. You know, God and Christ, the Father and Christ, they love everybody. They love the world. But they don't have a relationship with everyone. Is Christ friends with the wicked? That's a good question. Is Jesus Christ friends with the wicked, with people who reject him? And I would submit to you that no, he is not friends with those people. He loves them, and he spoke with them, and he taught them, and he helped them in some cases, maybe healed them. But he does not call them friends. He says very clearly, John 15, verse 13, he says, greater love has no one than this, than to lay down one's life for his friends. You are my friends if you do whatever I command you. Christ wants the disciples, or his friends who are with him, to be yoked with him, in a sense. You know, do not be unequally yoked. They have to walk and live the way Christ would walk and live. You are my friends if you do whatever I command you. No longer do I call you servants, for a servant does not know what his master is doing, but I have called you friends. For all things I heard from my Father, I have made known to you. So, folks, brethren, young people and old people, I would submit to you that we need to choose our friends carefully. They have a great influence on us. Choosing our friends or those that we're surrounded by, our environment, is, in a sense, indirectly, I'm saying indirectly, choosing good or evil. Choosing who you're with is, it can be, or is choosing good or evil, because we all influence one another. Okay, this leads me to my last point, and this is the most important. And like I say, I hope I didn't put you to sleep yet, but this is it. This is the biblical principle that will guarantee you success in your life. No matter what your idea of success, or I would say whatever road you're going to go down, path or career, this will guarantee success in life. And this is to prioritize God and put God first in everything you do. Put God in everything you do, everything, in school, in work, career path, in relationships. You know, if you're ever in a position or place and you say, I can't really bring God into this room, not into this party, so to speak. We shouldn't be there. God has to be in everything we do. And this is a clear biblical principle for success. Proverbs 3, verse 6 says, in all of your ways, acknowledge him. And I think, okay, there's lots of things in life. Life is complicated, lots of things to do, see, experience, go through. I mean, can God really be in all my ways, everything I need to acknowledge him in every aspect of my life? Well, Proverbs 3, 6 says that. And there are other scriptures that tell us or teach us that same thing. That is to put God in everything we do. Turn with me over to James 4. I'm going to wrap this up soon. Turn with me to James 4. James 4 and starting in verse 13. And think about this. Again, we're starting, some of us or many of us might be starting a new place or journey in life, and we're making plans. God gives us ability to reason, human logic. Those are blessings, a good thinking, clear thinking mind. But James puts this in perspective along with what we've already said. Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we will go to such and such a city, spend a year there, buy and sell and make a profit. Okay, we've got a business plan. Here's what we're going to do. Move forward. Go do it. Go do it. Yeah, let's go do it. Let's go make some money. Who wants to be wealthy? Yes, a couple hands up. Only two people now. Everybody else has given up on wealth. Man, I did not intend that in this message. Okay, let's go do this. Buy and sell. Spend a year there. Verse 14, whereas you don't know what will happen tomorrow. What do we talk about from Solomon in the book of Ecclesiastes? Life is uncertain. Well, James is saying it here in the New Testament. What is your life? It's even a vapor that appears for a little time and then vanishes away. Oof, it's gone. Life is short. Experiences are short. You know, the younger you are, the bigger and longer things take. I mean, when you're 14, how long does it take to turn 15 so you can get your, what's it called? Your learner's permit. Or how long does it take to turn 16 or 18 or 21? Man, when do I turn 21 so I could buy a beer or rent a hotel room or go on a trip or whatever it is? Things take forever. Well, James is telling you, and you learn this too as you get older. I know you've heard your parents or grandparents say it. As you get older in life, time flies by quicker and quicker. And it really, truly does. It really does. It goes by quickly. It vanishes away. James said, instead of saying things like that because your life is just a vapor, instead of saying, okay, let's go do this business plan and make a lot of money, he says, instead you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we shall live and do this or that. What's he saying? Put God in everything. Prioritize God. Make him number one. Involve him in every decision. How do you know whether you should take this class or go down this career path? Pray about it. Put God in it. Ask him for help and direction, guidance. He will give it. He will give it. He will help when you put him there. Verse 16, now you boast in your arrogance, and talking like that without God in the picture, James says, all that boasting, all such boasting is evil. It's not good. It's not good. Remember to put God in everything. Colossians 3, just a couple more passages here. Colossians 3. And verse 17, Colossians 3 and verse 17, here we read again, whatever you do in word or deed, do all in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks to God the Father through him. And he goes on to talk about relationships that we're going to have. We could tie this in, point 2 and 3 together. Relationships that we have, guess what? God needs to be in it. God needs to be in it. Verse 18, wives, submit to your own husbands as is fitting in the Lord. Wives, husbands, love your wives and do not be bitter toward them. There's a marital relationship. When you get married one day, oh, make sure God is in that covenant. He needs to be part of it for it to be successful. What's part of a successful life? Well, in terms of marriage, it's having a successful marriage. Living joyfully, learning to share and really love one another and give yourself to that other person, well, put God in it. Put God in the marriage. Children, obey your parents in all things, for this, again, is well-pleasing to the Lord. Obey your parents. Are there any parents who would disagree with that? Well, no, of course not. That's rhetorical. I know. Obey your parents, and you make your parents happy. They're glad. They're thankful. They love it. This is pleasing to the Lord. Fathers, do not provoke your children, lest they become discouraged. And he talks about slaves and masters. And I'll go over this one just for a moment, because this is a relationship that's not necessarily a familial, but someone else we might have in the world. Whatever, however this might apply to us in a business sense, maybe. Someone that has authority or power over us. Bond servants, obey in all things your masters according to the flesh, not with eye service, not being a hypocrite, not a surface level, not as men pleasers, but insincerity of heart, fearing God. And whatever you do, do it heartily. Hey, this is like what Solomon says, as to the Lord, you do it heartily and not to men, knowing that from the Lord you will receive the reward of the inheritance, for you serve the Lord Christ. Huh? So if you're a bondservant, if you're a family member, whatever it is, you do it and you serve the Lord Christ, depending on how we do it. If we put God in it and strive to do it his way in a manner pleasing to him, we're serving Christ. He who does wrong will be repaid for what he has done. There's no partiality. One day, if you have authority over someone, if you have a company, your manager, supervisor, perhaps this principle could apply as well. Chapter 4, verse 1, Master, give your bondservants what is just and fair, knowing that you also have a master in heaven. Again, whatever position, place, and road you go down, put God in it. You are guaranteed success. I said earlier of Solomon, and I wonder, you know, where is Solomon at in life when he wrote the book of Ecclesiastes? Where do you think he was? He was old, young, middle-aged. The book itself doesn't say specifically. I tend to think he's an older person. He talks about the life experiences he has, and he speaks of pleasures, you know, above and beyond, musical. Of course, he had many women, just many different things, feast that he threw. And Solomon, at whatever point he did write this book, and again, we don't know for certain, but it seems like maybe it's towards the latter part of his life, he does come to the right conclusion. And you know this, let's end here. Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, chapter 12. Ecclesiastes chapter 12. He says this. Ecclesiastes 12, let's read verse 9, starting in verse 9. He says, Moreover, because the preacher was wise, he still taught the people knowledge. Yes, he pondered and sought out and set in order many proverbs. The preacher sought to find acceptable words, and what was written was upright, words of truth. The words of the wise are like goads. In other words, they guide, they help, they urge on. And the words of scholars are like well-driven nails given by one shepherd. Who's the one shepherd that gives wise words, instruction, teaching, and learning? Where does wisdom and understanding come? Where does wisdom and understanding come from? It comes from the Almighty. One shepherd. Further, my son, be admonished by these, verse 12, of making many books there is no end, and much study. And this verse always sticks in my head. Much study is wearisome to the flesh. In the sermonette, it was mentioned about how there's so many things out there. You know, sometimes I just call it, there's so much noise. There's so much noise, it's so distracting. And I can imagine Solomon being this super mega wealthy king and enjoying all these pleasures and things in life. I can imagine him getting to a place where he's just wearied by it. And he says things like, oh, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. I could see that. But he says this, verse 13, let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is man's all. God will bring every work into judgment, including every secret thing, whether good or evil. So young folks, middle-aged folks, old folks, if we want success in life, that is the most important, is prioritize and put God number one. Try a variety of things. Be adventurous. I'm not saying skydive, but be adventurous. Be adventurous. Do things that are fun, interesting, as long as it's within the confines of God's law. Choose your friends carefully. Oh, they will yield and wield so much influence over you throughout life. Choose your circle of people carefully, in and outside the church. And again, that last point, always keep God in everything you do. Put him as number one.